The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, meddling with things beyond our comprehension. Taking one jar-based super bundle of synapses, a calculating machine capable of processing false back threes and inside-out goalies faster than most of us can wade through custard, and pitting it, face two crackling glass brain jar, against the upstart, the hot young buck of the tactical analysis world. It's Cox, the Wilson, like the Hustler, but hotter. Yep, today, beware, managers of Europe, the single most high-powered concentration of football brain power ever assembled is about to be turned on your feeble tactical fumblings. Also, Barry's in. Plus Pose, Sid, and all the usual in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hello, Barry Glendinning.
Hello.
Hello, Jonathan Wilson.
Hello.
Hello, Michael Cox.
Hello.
Hello, everybody. Hello, producer Ben, while we're at it, and you listeners too. Jonathan, when Ben booked you for today, I believe you said something like, might this not be a bit like putting Lampard and Gerrard in the same midfield?
Did I say that?
Apparently you did. Ben was very excited because he said yes, and look who we've got in the Barry role. Quite literally Barry.
I'm so scared about what's about to happen. I'm wearing knee pads and elbow pads and a big helmet.
No, it will be all right.
Did Ben by any chance invent that conversation about Lampard Gerrard because he had the Barry joke? Because that would work well.
I'll leave that to listeners' own imagination. Own imagination.
Just before we came in, I tweeted and said, because someone had tweeted, send in your questions, and the questions were all monotonously boring. So I tweeted and said, look, we don't actually want questions about football because it's something that'll explode. It's like crossing the beams on Ghostbusters.
Right.
And then, needless to say, the usual git is sort of a... Nobody tunes in Football Weekly to listen to your inane blatherings.
Right.
We're genuinely
But they
interested.
Follow you on Twitter to listen to your inane...
Yeah. Well, I'm curious. Delighted that person has appointed themselves shop steward to speak on behalf of the however many...
Anyway, let's roll on then. Big week. Champions League semi-finals sorted out. Most of them, of course, were all too painfully clear after the first leg. But we now know that Man United are through to face Schalke after their win against Chelsea. Well done to United, first of all.
Yeah, fairly deserved. I thought a better side over both legs, so yeah.
Bit of love for the old-timers. Giggs, Van der Sar, magnificent. Evergreen, Jonathan.
Yeah, Giggs was fantastic. I mean, to set up all three goals they scored. I think you look at that midfield without Fletcher with Giggs and Carrick next to each other, and you wonder if there's enough ball winning in there. But they held the ball well enough. It didn't matter against Chelsea. I mean, whether it'll matter against Schalke or in the final if they get there, well, possibly they will have to change shape. But they were great over the two legs.
That's what you say, but Michael, take that to pieces. Come on.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with that. I'm afraid I was watching
only broadly. Well, why? What are you picking on?
No, it was spot on actually.
Oh, thank you.
Spot on. But no, I was watching. The first half again of that game, and I was surprised how well
he watched it twice.
Showing off for them. Some of us only need to watch it once.
No, I was watching the first half again, and I was actually surprised at how good Chelsea were in the first few minutes. Because by the end of the game, they obviously were down to 10 men, they weren't pressing, they didn't really have the ball. But I thought they started really brightly, and I thought Ancelotti's tactics were actually spot on, with the one exception of the fact that he didn't play Drogba, he played Torres, who clearly isn't fit, isn't confident, etc. And the only three players that Chelsea had really were the fullbacks, and they were trying to cross the ball. Their crossing wasn't very good. But if that's going to be your main approach, as it did look like for the most of the game, then you've got to have someone like Drogba in there who's capable of winning crosses.
Mm.
They kind of went in carrying a passenger. Like Torres was lamentably poor in the first half, and they vastly improved in the second when Drogba came on. And who knows? I mean, does anyone actually think picking Torres was Ancelotti's decision? I can't believe that.
It does seem an extraordinary thought that Abramovic is having that big an influence that he will actually pick the team for this bigger game. Is that what we're actually saying?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
That's what a lot of people seem to say.
Yeah, but it's an extraordinary thing that he jeopardised his own team's chance of winning the tournament in order to make a point about a signing he made to win the tournament. The whole thing is contradictory. I mean, I think the point about Ancelotti's tactics, going for the Christmas tree, the 4-3-2-1, which, of course, he played at Milan when Berlusconi let him and did insist on two up front. If you look at the two, if you look at the two creators, he had Lampard and he had Anelka. both of them, you know, very good players in their own roles, but I don't think either of them you say is natural in that role. And you compare that to Milan, where you had Kaká, Rivaldo, Seedorf, Rui Costa. It's a very different type of player. And I think that possibly explains Chelsea's relative lack of creativity, that they had possession. To an extent, they managed to restrict Carrick, who, I think, you know, alongside Giggs, had been the outstanding player of the first leg. So they achieved that. But having got the ball, they didn't really have any outlet. And the problem of using the fullbacks, which were only their only real outlet, the problem of doing that was that they left space in behind them. And it was twice early on that Rooney got in behind Ashley Cole and almost created something. So you could see that was always going to be a potential danger for them. And for all the possession they had, the only two chances they really had, they both came in the space of about a minute. It was a cross from the left, which was deflected, and Ferdinand headed it out, and then Torres laid it off for Nelku, shot just wide. And if that had been 2 feet to the left, it would have gone in. And then they had the Malouda drive, you know, his driving run. He was half-checked and came to Lampard, who mishit the shot. But apart from that, there was nothing. And even those two chances, one of them's a deflected cross that's half-cleared, one of them's a run that's stopped and the ball breaks. They're not created chances for chances that have come about. So, I mean, really, until Drogba came on, they created nothing.
Mm.
And even the chances Drogba created, there was a sense of Drogba being so desperate to prove himself, so desperate to do it all himself. I mean, you saw that, I think, particularly...
Well, it's a lovely goal, though.
It's a lovely goal. And I think, yeah, the difference you see between Drogba now and Torres now is that when that ball came to him, you had absolutely no doubt he'd score.
Mm.
Whereas with Torres, I suspect you'd have had absolutely no doubt he'd managed to mess it up.
Yeah, well, 11 games now. That joke about David Blaine doing the rounds, very funny, is to return to the Christmas tree in a Santa-esque fashion will be accompanied with the sack, apparently, according to all today's papers, for Ancelotti. Is he really going to go? Because who are they going to get to replace him? Barry, you're across the rumours today, aren't you?
Well, depending on which tabloid you read, they're going to get... a dream team of Jose Mourinho with Gus Hiddink as director of football. Gus Hiddink on his own, Frank Rijkaard or Marco van Basten.
Well, the first two, Mourinho's not going to come. Hiddink's busy with Turkey until November, I think, he said, having read this in various papers as well this morning.
Well, he was busy with Russia before when was still able to manage Chelsea,
yeah,
so that
true.
Wouldn't conceivably be a problem.
I don't think Hiddink's that happy with Turkey. I don't think things are going
so you think
well
he would return?
I think it's a possibility, yeah. I think if the offer was good enough, it would be a way for him to get out of Turkey before, you know, he fails to qualify for the European Championship, which is a possibility.
All right, yeah, very interesting.
I wonder if Villas-Boas is on the cards as well, the Porto manager.
It's a bit early, isn't it?
Possibly, but similar-ish stage to when Mourinho came. Okay, he hasn't won the Champions League, but he's done a better job with Porto than Mourinho did in terms of league victories, etc.
Mm. But everybody wins the title at Porto.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm.
And he's possibly... He wouldn't transform the side, actually. Because I was thinking about Chelsea in this match, how, like Jonathan was saying, they lack a creator. And they kind of reminded me of a side like in a slightly lesser league like Porto that is used to just turning up in the league and just dismantling the opposition through pace and power and just having better players.
Mm.
They don't really have anyone intelligent on the ball, you know, who kind of slows things down, looks to play a pass. I thought it was notable that the goal, which, like you say, I thought was a fantastic finish by Drogba, but Essien just bypassed the creative players, just hit the ball forward and Drogba controlled it and scored, because you weren't really expecting the creative players, if you can call Lampard and Kalou creative.
Mm.
They just weren't doing anything. It sounds ridiculous because Chelsea won the double last season, but I'm not sure Ancelotti's ever known his best side or his best formation or his best 11, because he started out with this diamond in his first season, which went okay, but it needed width from fullback. Then when Cole and Bossingwa got injured, he changed it. And then he had this almost transformation that was almost solely because Drogba was off at the African Cup of Nations and he was playing Anelka and Malouda floating around all over the place. Then Drogba came back and it seemed to work towards the end of the season, but even when they went to Old Trafford, he had to drop Drogba from the side. Because
what about the start of this season when everything was going brilliantly?
Yeah, that's I guess the one exception.
Yeah, but look at who they were playing. Yeah, the fixture list was easy at the start of this season for them. I mean, this has been a very bizarre season in terms of fixtures. That Chelsea had a really easy run to start with. The Man City game was the first tough game. They lost that. You could see that the wobble was imminent. But it's not just Chelsea have had that. United actually have quite a hard end to the season. Sunderland have just had a run of seven difficult games in a row, which has totally derailed their season. So the fixture computer this season has it's clumped fixtures together.
All right, I got dangerously close and I got blasted back by a kind of lightning arc of mental power.
Do you think we're reaching a stage now where, A, that top flight, you know, sort of middle to top of the Premier League managers don't care about getting sacked? I mean, Ancelotti, I'm sure, would be quite happy to go back to Italy, maybe take over at Roma and get have a big wheelbarrow full of money to push away to make up for the last year of his contract.
I take you.
There's no shame in getting sacked from clubs anymore either, because you're increasingly at the whim of chairmen or owners who don't appear to have the foggiest idea of what they're doing.
Mm.
And I remain mystified as to how these people made so much money in the first place, because they don't seem to be very bright.
I think you're right, but I think it's not just there's a lack of shame. It also, these managers now have more than enough money to live very, very comfortably. You look at when, for instance, Brian Clough left Derby, he had to take the Brighton job because he had to feed himself, pay off a mortgage, feed his family. Yeah, he was actually in real financial trouble then, or potentially in real financial trouble, if he hadn't got a job within a few months.
Mm. If only there was a book to tell us that kind of story about the great Brian Clough.
Well, interestingly enough, there will be one coming out in October.
In October? What's it called, Jonathan?
It's called Nobody Ever Says Thank You.
Boy, isn't that true?
That's quite clearly not true. Lots of people say thank you.
Do they mean it?
Artistic license and that. Yeah. Anyway, now, we were going to talk about United and what awaits them at the weekend. I have the feeling that part one might be already exhausted, might be bursting at the seams. So should we just do that musical thing and wipe the slate clean? All right, United's big clash with Man City at the weekend is coming up a little bit later on when we turn our attention to the FA Cup. Right now, though, we have Sid Lowe. Sid, we've been doing some calculations. We think that there could be four Clasicos coming up in 17 days soon. Before you descend into your concrete isolation bunker with the stayer for the duration, do tell us, is the mood in Spain, is it excited, resigned? What's the reaction?
No, it's excited. Everybody's gone absolutely crazy. And in a way, and this is what I was writing about for The Guardian this morning, in a way, this is just the confirmation of what we all thought was coming for a long time, what everybody assumed would happen once the draw was made and we were spared the possibility of them facing each other. I think it would have been four times in 14 days with the quarterfinals. We knew that this was a big, big possibility. And this makes it even bigger because it means that it's set up absolutely perfectly. Four games in a row that probably decide all three competitions from everybody's point of view. It's almost as if the final of the Champions League doesn't exist, that this is the game that really matters. And it builds to it perfectly as well, because the first game is probably the least relevant because it's the Clásico in the league, and the assumption is that Barcelona will probably win that anyway. The second one is the Copa del Rey, which being a final is huge, but it's not quite as big as the Champions League. And the third one for Champions League. So it's almost as if it's been set up perfectly, this kind of perfect progression towards a huge kind of finale.
It's like a World Series of massively overhyped Spanish football.
That's exactly what it is, yeah. And I think there is a concern. I don't think anyone else in Spain seems to have expressed it yet, but I've certainly got a concern that what if this doesn't become a really special one-off? What if this is something that keeps happening every year because of the dominance of Madrid and Barcelona? But I think in the short term, at least, despite the desire, I think, to play to some extent the role of party pooper and say, well, look, let's worry about whether this means something really terrible. In the short term, let's just enjoy it.
Well, they come into this game fresh from exciting quarter-final second legs. Barcelona, with their excitingly luminescent green shirts, winning 1-0 away at Shakhtar Donetsk, and a similar scoreline for Real Madrid in the clash at White Hart Lane. What was the reaction to that?
The reaction was that it was always going to happen. In a way, I would say there's a very, very tiny little bit of irritation with Mourinho. Not irritation, that's probably not the right word. One or two people questioning whether it was such a good idea to run the risk of the players who already had yellow cards picking up a second one. That only happened to Ricardo Carvalho. But he's a relatively significant absentee, I think, from the first leg of the semi-final. I think, in a way, he was sort of right to him. In fact, I was almost wondering, is it worth them trying to force a yellow now and miss the first leg to make sure they're available for the second, which might be more important, and make sure they're available for a hypothetical final as well. But it was really just seen as a game to go and play, to kill off, to make sure it wasn't any real problems, and to get through. Yesterday's game was, as I say, almost as if it was irrelevant.
All right. couple of other quick things. No Carvalho, then, in the first leg against Barcelona. But Kaká coming back into the picture. Is he going to have a big role, do you think, in this dramatic end of season for Real?
I'm starting to think he might. Not very long ago, everybody was giving up on him. Nobody expected him to play the kind of part that he's played over the last couple of games, coming on against Spurs, coming on against Spurs in the first leg as well. He started and scored two penalties against Athletic Bilbao at the weekend. And bit by bit, you start to think, I wonder if he might have a role to play. I suspect he won't start any of these key games, except possibly the league game, because Real Madrid may well try and protect one or two players or rest one or two players ready for the Copa del Rey final. But he could well have a part to play, and it would be obviously really, really huge for him, but I think really big as well for the club, because there is a sense of, you know, this superstar who was supposed to be almost a standard bearer of the second Galactic project along with Cristiano Ronaldo. It just hasn't happened for him so far.
Sid, if either Barcelona or Real Madrid were to, say, for example, lose all four of the upcoming Clásicos, how long, if ever, do you think it would take them to recover from that?
That's a good question. I think in terms of the structure of each club, it's not going to be a problem. I think Mourinho will stay at Madrid next year, no matter what. I think Pep Guardiola will stay at Barcelona, no matter what. I think emotionally, it's probably bigger if Real Madrid win it than if Barcelona do, because if Barcelona were to win all three, or at least, let's say, for argument's sake, to win the two most important ones, the league and the Champions League, then I think there would be a sense that, well, Barcelona are carrying on as they are, and Real Madrid, well, they've won something in the Copa del Rey, or even if they win nothing, they've still got further than they had in the past. For example, Mourinho's Real Madrid side have already played a game more than they did last year under Pellegrini. So I'm not sure that structurally it's a big difference, but of course, it will really knock them sideways.
All right, Sid. Listen, bit of love for Raul, another of these golden oldies. We mentioned Giggs and Van der Sar in part one. Raul, eh?
Yeah, somebody pointed this out to me yesterday, and it's quite a good point. So we've got a European Champions League semi-final, and it's Raul up against Giggs. What year is this?
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Magnificent stuff. Sid, you've probably got plenty to get on with, so we'll let you go, and look forward to catching up with you on Monday.
Fantastic. Speak to you then.
Thanks, Sid.
Raul played against Van der Sar in the 95-96 European Cup semi-finals, I think.
Wow.
I was looking on Soccer Base last night.
All right. No, that point's gone unanswered. What, do you think that they were any better then than they are now as players?
I can't remember when Giggs has had such a large influence over such a big game as he has over this time, and he set up all three goals.
Yeah, and Van der Sar's just, I think, has looked more complete than ever before.
He's fantastic, yeah.
Well, that save from the Torres header in the first leg was, you know, a really good save. You wonder what that might do to Torres' career as well. If that had gone in, would that have changed things
and
for him?
Compare Van der Sar to 10 years ago, because wasn't 2001 when he was having that shaky spell at Juventus, when he made a couple of errors in big games?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He cost them European.
And people keep saying that it's strange that he went to Fulham in the middle of three such big clubs. But that really was his level at that point, wasn't it? That was his reputation. I think a lot of people were saying he was over as a goalkeeper. Mm. So it's remarkable that he's still playing now, 10 years on.
Remarkable indeed. Now, Spurs, we mentioned their 1-0 defeat to Real Madrid Wednesday night. And
I've scored past Van der Sar.
Wow. All right, then.
Do you want to
put pieces of paper aside on your desk? Do tell, Jonathan.
It was 1999.
Yes.
It was at the Constant Van den Stock Stadium in Brussels.
I know where it is.
it was shortly after the draw for Euro 2000, and Adidas did a thing with various journalists where you play tested the Adidas Terrestra Silverstream, the official ball of Euro 2000. And we did these various drills. So you dribbled against Zidane. He was better than me.
you dribbled against Zidane?
Yeah.
Out of your mouth or with a football?
you ran around cones and kind of you passed it against.
He wasn't
ball.
Running alongside you. He did it and then set a time, and you had to try and match.
No,
it.
He went alongside everybody.
You're kidding?
No, he beat everybody. Obviously, he did it in like 7 seconds. It took me about 28, I think. I mean, I'm rubbish at football. You should bear that in mind.
No, but still, it's just extraordinary that they would get basically Zidane and the rest.
And then we got to interview them afterwards. But one of the drills as well was Van der Sar in goal, and you got Anderlecht youth team players putting in crosses. You got three crosses each. The two good crosses, which were on my head, I managed to kind of skim miles wide. But then there was quite a bad cross, it was at waist height, just behind us. So swung a leg at it, pinged off a sweet spot in the middle of my shin, and it flew in the bottom corner.
Right. That explains that dodgy period that he had for the subsequent 3 years. He wrecked his confidence.
And he watched it go past him and applauded gently and nodded. Right. And that was also the day
Did you wheel away and put your shirt over your head?
Well, no, because I was actually quite embarrassed by it because it had so clearly come just off just below my knee. It was a bit like Rooney's over kick against Man City. It looked good, but when you saw it in slow motion, it was horrible. That was also the day that Del Piero was doing a free kick drill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he must have had a bet with the Anderlecht goalkeeping coach who went in goal. And it started out, you didn't have a keeper there, and you're just bending it over this metal wall. You know, you have the five men. And Del Piero steps up, bang, top corner. No keeper there. It's very easy. Everybody's kind of, not necessarily putting a top corner, but scoring. And then the second time I went round, they put in this goalkeeping coach. Del Piero again, bang, top corner. And everybody's, because they're trying to hit it a bit harder because there's a keeper there now, they're putting it over, or they're hitting it in the wall, or the keeper's saving it. And I was second last in the queue. I've been shuffling backwards because I mean, I really am awful at football. I can't tell you how awful I am. And I thought, well, this keeper's taking a massive hop to his left all the time because everybody's trying to put top right corner. I'll put him bottom left. And that takes the wall out of the equation as well. So I hit it around the bottom left side of the wall. Keeper's taking a step to his left and he can't get back. And it takes quite a nice bounce off it. It pitched on the 6 yard line. And you know how on for a proper ground, 6 yard line's often kind of quite low because of the constant, you have a paint going over it. It pitched on the back side of that and kicked up and he couldn't get back across. And Del Piero came up to me, patted me on the shoulder.
No.
Il Maestro.
Right.
I think
Did you tweet this dream as well, or not?
No, Charlie White from the Sun was there. Ask him.
All right. Because you can believe everything you hear from. Anyway, well, there you go. That's amazing, Jonathan. Thanks for that.
Yeah, that's all right. Just saying, Van der Sar, not all that.
Not all that.
I think Jimbo's jealous because Del Piero called you El Maestro.
El Maestro, yeah. Spurs, etc., 1-0, blah, 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 blah. And, of course, they're now trying to chase down that fourth place that Man City are in. We'll be talking Man City a little bit later on. Of course, they're playing in the FA Cup semi-final this weekend against Manchester United. But what about Spurs? They're 3 points behind City. They have a game in hand. But there is that spectre of a, you know, kind of typical Harry Redknapp approach, blowing loads of money and then not quite making the target.
I think, you know, their frustration with the Champions League must be that there were times against Real Madrid where it looked like they might have been able to do it, but they shot themselves in the foot so comprehensively by, A, letting in a very soft early goal, then Crouch being sent off, and then letting in a soft fourth goal, which, I mean, 3-0, I don't think realistically they're going to get back, but there was a tiny chance, 4-0, there was never a chance. So, I mean, they chucked away the tie for things not to do with their ability, really.
No.
So we never saw them really test themselves against Madrid.
Are they going to catch City, do you think, with Tevez out for, what is it, a month now, they say?
Well, possibly. I mean, City looked awful at Liverpool, didn't they?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, Tottenham's run-in's not easy, is it? I think they've
got to play Arsenal. They're at home to Arsenal. Then they've got West Brom at home, which is no longer quite as easy as it might have previously looked. Chelsea away, Blackpool at home, Man City away on May the 10th, massive game, that one. Liverpool away, and then they finish at home to Birmingham.
It's a tough run, isn't it?
Is it? City's is sort of easier. Well, actually, is it? It's all against bottom half teams, a lot of whom are going to be playing for their very survival.
Yeah, but isn't that a bit of a myth that it's harder to play bottom half teams?
I don't know. There's a reason they're in the bottom half, you're suggesting.
Yeah, and yeah. Although they're fighting hard, they've actually been fighting just as hard all season.
Okay, good. Well, there you go. In other news, Schalke beat Inter, etc. Yes. A couple of posts. Coconut, with a little bit of information about that terrific penalty. Did you see this? The guy who does a backflip while scoring a penalty. Yeah, and I didn't know where it was from. It is FC Bar. They're Swiss. Sound Welsh, actually, didn't they? But the player in question
was very famous, James.
Are they?
They've featured in the Champions League many
FC
times.
Bar, not Baal.
Oh, sorry.
Bar.
you just said not FC Bar, FC Bar. That just sounds exactly the same.
All right, then. But the player in question was a Finn. Supermarket sweeper then ups the ante. Thusly, he says, in response to the backflip penalty from the team with a lot of vowels, watch these crazy Scandinavians. Well, they're actually from Iceland. They're called Stjarnan. And Barry, you've seen them at work. They are unbelievable. They, to be honest, are wasted in football. They regard the game, I think it's fair to say, as an excuse to put their mime abilities into practice. So basically, any goal they've scored, they will have a designated celebration. And other footballers watching this will, I mean, you can't. You're just going to give up with celebration because these guys have already gone to the limit. They have taken it as far as it can go. If you haven't seen it, Barry, would you think fair to say?
I think everyone's seen it.
Oh, have they?
Yeah.
Have they?
Yeah.
Am I the last?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, then. They're brilliant then, aren't they, everyone?
Yes.
Yeah, they are.
The fellow who wrote in about the Swiss penalty.
Oh, yeah.
Can you translate what was shouted by the cameraman after the goal went in?
There you go, coconuts.
Because it sounded
that
to me, it may have been a French word or Italian word or German word, but it sounded to me like the guy with the camera just shouted football when the ball went in the goal, which if it's true is
he's not wrong,
is the best reaction to seeing that.
All right then, Sam Fisher's got a he's got an important tactical point. He says, why are a lot of Italian teams going a different way in terms of tactics than the rest of Europe? Why?
I presume that's directed at me, is it? I think it's only fair I give Jonathan or Michael a chance to answer one of these tactics questions.
All right, go on then.
If he's talking about why do they play so narrow?
Well, for example, they were playing five at the back or three at the back, depending how you want to call it, for ages before other people have adopted it. And specifically, yeah, the narrowness of
Well, I don't think it's necessarily before other people adopted it. I mean, there was a spell when playing three or five at the back became popular in England.
I should say 90s. Re-adopted it. Obviously, it's kind of...
Well, no, I think that was probably the first time it had been adopted in that form in England. But, I mean, you see a divergence in tactics in the 60s that some countries go with the libero. So Italy went with the libero. Germany went with the libero. Scandinavia at that time went with the libero and then switched to 4-4-2.
But now, why do you think now they're...
Well, because to an extent we're all conditioned by our country's history and the culture there. So Italy's never really produced great wingers for this reason. In Italy, the tendency right from the days of Herrera's Inter onwards was you had on the left, you had a very attacking left back, so Fichetti being the great example, and then on the left side in front of him, you'd have basically a centre forward who played wide left, which is what Rossi did initially, cutting in. So he's a centre forward who plays to the left, but gets out of the way to let the fullback come forward. On the right, you have the opposite. You have a fullback who shuffles across to Bergnich in the great inter side, who's basically a man marker but shuffles across to right back when he needs to. And in front of him, the Tonante, the returner, Jaya, in Herrera's team, who's sort of a shuttling right winger. He's not a winger in the sense of Stanley Matthews. He's somebody who gets up and down. So there's no real concept of a winger in Italian football. There never has been. There's the odd, in Donadoni, I guess you'd give as an example of somebody who was a winger.
Conti, maybe?
Yeah, even Conti, I think, comes in that Tonante.
Lentini's has produced a bit. Interesting shout before his unfortunate dalliance with Rita Scilacci.
Yeah, I mean, there are the odd examples, but I mean, there's nowhere near as many as you'd find in countries with a 4-4-2 tradition.
Right.
And it's also,
okay, good, yeah.
It's also related to the lack of pace as well, isn't it? And the Italian game
you're
is still
them slow.
Yeah, well, it's often held up as quite a negative thing. I quite like the kind of more slow, patient
approach.
Gives
you a bit more time to appreciate, isn't it? It's not.
I genuinely think it does.
I agree.
But when you then come up against pace,
yeah,
you're really going to struggle. And the Inter side in the first leg against Schalke was just amazing how prone it was, particularly to width and also to pacey players.
Mm.
And actually, on this note, it's strange because the traditionally big Italian clubs, Inter, Roma and Milan, have all played this 4-3-1-2. And the two clubs who are kind of punching above their weight this season is Udinese and Napoli, who have gone with wing-backs and with width and do play with a little pace.
Do you know they face each other this weekend?
Oh, that was my line, James.
Oh, sorry.
But that should be a really
it's
good game.
It's a huge game, that.
I'm really
Napoli-Udinese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the reason the wing-backs work there and don't really seem to work anywhere else in Europe is because everybody else in Italy plays so narrow.
Right.
The wing-backs can get up and down. They don't really have a great defensive job to do.
Right. No, I was going to say... Chievo would be another example of this. When they came up in 2001, and they were a bit of a Blackpool situation, because everyone said, OK, there's one nailed on certainty for relegation this year, it's Chievo. And instead, I think they qualified for Europe that first year. It was extraordinary. And they did it because they had wide players, and nobody else in Italy had.
And Eriberto.
And then, or was it?
And Manfredini, wasn't it?
Yeah. And Cesena started off brightly with a similar policy this
season. Yeah.
Anyway, could go on, but I'm not going to.
No, I have a question.
All right.
Why did you say, or was it?
Oh,
I don't understand
Michael
that.
Michael Cox takes
joke
up the story.
I'm sure you remember better than me. He was a fake name. He had a fake passport to be 5 years younger or something,
yeah,
wasn't it?
I don't know how many years, but he had an 18-month ban for adopting the identity, I think, of a dead player called Heriberto, and his actual name was Luciano.
Mm.
And he came back. He was never the same player again once, you know. It was bizarre. It was almost like a mental thing. He genuinely thought that he was 5 years younger. And it would work, you know.
Am I right in saying that he only revealed his identity because he wanted his son to have his true...
Yeah.
Surname, which I think is quite a nice
Very
story,
nice.
Isn't it?
I think he's... And he's still out there, isn't he, Luciano?
Yeah.
He floated on forever. Yeah. He might even be in the Chievo side still. I'm ashamed to say, I don't know. He was until recently, certainly.
He's now at Leicester City, he's probably playing under the name of Yakubu.
Ah, we laugh. Good. Well done to Crawley, now promoted to the Football League.
Is it well done to Crawley, though?
No one likes Crawley. They just got promoted to the Football League.
Yeah, but no one likes them. They're the Manchester City of the Blue Square Premier.
Anyway, and to their fellow Sussex team, Brighton.
Yes.
Who, this midweek, with five games still to go, conquered promotion to the Championship, where they are full of ambition. Their chairman, Tony the Lizard Bloom, international poker player,
well, interestingly,
he's targeting a top six finish.
He's being constantly referred to as a poker player, Tony Bloom.
I've met him at a poker tournament, actually.
Well, he does play poker, right. But he cites that as his hobby. I think he made most of his money setting up a Asian handicap football betting website called Premier Bet.
That's wholesome, then.
And then selling it on. Asian handicap, you're immediately thinking of... illegal Indian bookmakers and whatnot. It's not like that. Oh. Asian handicap betting is where you bet on a team with a minus one goal or plus 2.5 goals or whatever.
Handicapping system, in other words.
Yeah. He's nicknamed the Lizard because apparently an old friend of his suspects him of, having alligator blood, so which begs the question, alligator blood.
Well, why is he called the Lizard?
I don't know. That's what's odd. He should be called the Alligator. But
this friend of his, pretty mixed up. Anyway.
But he's put over 93 million into Brighton.
Wow.
All in interest-free, unsecured loans.
Right. So. And he's built a new stadium with that. A lovely place it looks, Falmer. We talked about this the other day. They've already sold, I think, most of the season tickets for next season. As I say, he's targeting a top six finish in the Championship, i.e. to go straight into the playoffs for the Premier League. Premier League by when? When he took over, he said Premier League by, and I don't have the date. Oh, by 2019. So he's very much on course. Amazing, eh? Brighton. Yeah. Be a nice little trip to the seaside.
He does play poker, by the way, and he's a very good poker player, but he only considers it a hobby. He's made millions playing poker and in property.
When the UEFA Champions League final gets underway at Wembley on the 28th of May, just a few miles to the east at the Emirates, James Richardson and friends will be kicking off their own big event. It's the latest Football Weekly Live podcast, and you can get tickets. Is it a big event, Ben?
400.
400 seats.
Friends, I think.
But they'll all be gone by now, won't they?
Don't know.
Yeah, I think they're all gone by now. I don't know why I mentioned that. Although, two of those tickets will be in the St. Joseph's Maida Vale school auction. So if you're after a set, that's where to go. I don't know.
Tight.
And I'm a bit concerned that it might be after the actual event takes place, in which case my donation will be a bit of a damp squib. Anyway, there you go.
So
tickets cost £15 until the 13th of May. After that, they're going to go up to £20. Wow, I like this. Booking closes on the 24th of May. Go to guardian.co.uk/extra for more information. Sorry, Barry.
Why don't we just do the whole Emirates? No, we have 60,000.
Actually, Ben, that's a very good point. If we are...
And we could be sitting at a little table in the centre, sir.
Yeah, or raised on some kind of hydraulic pole. I like that idea.
With All spikes right. coming up through the floor like on Flash Gordon.
Yeah, and then we have to wrestle each other. Yeah.
Who wouldn't want to pay 15 quid to watch that?
Yep. Anyway, now moving along, in other interesting clashes coming up, of the not with spikes and baby oil variety, we have the FA Cup semi-finals at Wembley, Saturday and Sunday this weekend. Who wants to talk about Stoke Bolton?
Well, since, I think, 2008, when Stoke came up back up to the Premier League, they've played six times. Bolton have the edge. They've won three. Stoke have won two, and there's one draw. It really could go either way. Both of them are perfectly capable of winning the game.
Michael?
I think it's quite interesting because Stoke are obviously cast as a
horrible long ball side who just play route one and don't have any style. And Bolton under Owen Coyle have been characterised as, you know, casting that aside and playing short, neat, more intricate football. So it'd be interesting to see the match between them.
Hmm.
But I'm a little bit sceptical about this Bolton thing.
Oh.
Because I still think they do hit... I think they hit the ball.
Yeah, they know when to mix it up.
Yeah. I think they play the fourth most long passes in the league. And I saw an Opta Joe stat the
other day. Kevin Davis one?
Yeah.
About the flick-ons?
Yeah, he's made... Do you make flick-ons?
I would imagine you flick...
Anyway, he's flicked the ball on 200 times more than any other player in the Premier League.
It's a lot of flicking on.
Which I'm not sure how he could do that if they're playing this lovely, short, neat football.
That's not just this season, is it? Isn't that over his career, or is that just this season?
I thought it was this season.
Oh, really? That's extraordinary.
The worrying thing for Bolton is that the young lad from Chelsea, whose name has completely escaped.
Daniel Sturridge
is cup tied, so he won't be able to play.
Yeah, that is a worry, because that's the big irony, isn't it? Everyone's been saying, well, he's spent £50 million on Fernando Torres, and you had Daniel Sturridge there in your books, and he scored while Torres has got none in 11. He's got 7 in 7, hasn't he, in the Premier League?
I think so.
Yeah. And the last one was an absolute beauty.
I can't remember
who they were playing.
Curler against.
He spun and curled West Ham in against West Ham. Thanks for that. Yeah.
But I think Sturridge actually, there's a wider issue there, isn't there? Of players who go to big teams and just disappear. I mean, Sturridge hasn't been around for 18 months.
Hmm.
And he's probably young enough he can get over it. But you look at people like Joe Cole, Steve Sidwell, Scott Parker,
Wayne Bridge, I guess.
Yeah. Sean Wright Phillips, who lost a huge chunk of their career by. I mean, that just players have gone to Chelsea. I'm sure there's examples at other big clubs as well. I mean, Chelsea seemed to be, I guess, because of the most acquisitive club.
Yeah.
Man City could end up being a similar with Adam Johnson if he ends up dropping further down the pecking order there. The players who chase the cash and chase for Champions League football. And
Michael Johnson even as well. What happened to him?
Yeah, but I mean, he was there to start with, wasn't he? But yeah. it's a fair point that he's a you know, clearly a very, very good player coming through.
Right.
Who's now, I mean, he's had injuries and apparently I think his lifestyle possibly isn't necessarily congruent with that of a top footballer.
Oh, right.
But still, you know, he's a player who's not going to get another chance there and needs to move.
But do you think they are chasing the money, or do they genuinely believe that they can crack the first team?
Well, it's.
I personally believe they're chasing the money.
I guess it depends on the individual, doesn't it? But
also depends if the club wants to keep them on, because ultimately. But
what I'm saying is, it's a big danger. I mean, something like Sturridge going there that young. How many chances are you going to get there? And he hasn't had a chance, really, has he, there?
Well, and it's hard to see whether he will be given a chance maybe after the season, after he's done so well, because it would involve a lot of other players.
Well, if Drogba can't get in that team ahead of Torres, he's not going to, yes.
Yeah.
And also, it was a strange time to loan him out, because you could justify him not having a chance before, because Anelka and Drogba were the golden boot winners back-to-back.
Mm.
And then when they do need him in the team, and they do need some fresh blood, then they loan him out.
Yeah.
Now, David Bentley at Tottenham would be another example.
Indeed. Now, you mentioned City there, which I was going to leap on and segue nicely into the other FA Cup semi-final, the All-Manchester Derby coming up on Saturday. A lot of talk after the Chelsea win about the treble. Could this be a treble year? But, of course, this 90 minutes could end that even before it starts against City.
Yes, it could, although in the treble year they went to an extra time replay against Arsenal and won it with a Ryan Giggs goal. So, you know, they're used to doing things the hard way, and I think they're going to have to do it again.
All right. Do you think City are going to put up a lot of... are they going to be a tough obstacle to overcome after their abject performance at Anfield?
I think Tevez is a really big loss. I think Tevez has been fantastic this season. Personally, I think he's deserving of the Player of the Year award, actually. I think he's the key. If he's not in the side, they're going to have to, you know, someone else is going to have to step up. Balotelli's going to have one of his good games or something.
Mm. It's their best shot at a trophy in, what, 35 years, this, for City? So it is a massive match. And United trash-talking this fixture up. Alex Ferguson calling them desperate. Nemanja Vidic says that City are obsessed and a bunch of sulkers who wouldn't be tolerated at Old Trafford.
Is that trash-talking, or is that just a statement of fact?
Statement of fact, then. All right. Okay.
James Milner's behaviour when he was substituted against Liverpool was disgraceful. Mario Balotelli, I'm beginning to think, may be mentally disturbed.
Do you think?
He seems to have the mental capabilities of a small child. Good, physically attuned to be a good footballer, but just something missing. There's a couple of wires loose in his head.
Mm.
All right.
Does Milner's reaction not worry you deeply, given that I don't think there's any evidence of ever having reacted like that before at any club he's been at?
Yeah, he's the last player I would have suggested. A few people at Manchester City before have commented on how professional he is, how he'd never disagree with the manager's decision, first into training, last out of training, never caught in a nightclub. So to see him having a bit of a...
What did he actually do?
Nothing major. He was just substituted and then he was giving it the...
He was quite clearly deeply unimpressed at being substituted and thought he shouldn't have been. And I can appreciate someone's disappointed, although if I'd been on that City team, I think I'd have been glad to be hooked. But you mustn't... He's old enough at this stage to, you know, just be professional about, right, I've been taken off. And if you have a problem with it, go to the manager afterwards. Yeah.
A lot of people making the point as well that winning is contagious. You don't want bad performances ahead of a big game like this, and it is arguably now the biggest game of City's season, isn't it?
Yeah,
so far anyway.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, it's that whole debate about whether a trophy is more important than a Champions League qualification.
Mm-hmm.
The club would probably prefer the Champions League qualification, whereas I don't know what the supporters would prefer. That's up to them. But I think there'd probably be more of them who'd like to see them win a trophy.
Okay, in the Premier League this weekend, in the meantime, all sorts of exciting clashes. Let's just, to finish off, quickly whistle through one or two and maybe pick out a fixture or three that tickles our fancy. I don't know. Birmingham Sunderland being sued by a fan who was hit by a stray ball from Djibril Cissé. Exciting news there. Yes,
could be a lot of fans in for big windfalls in light of the recent run of form.
Now, there's a big clash at Bloomfield Road as Blackpool take on Wigan. Blackpool hovering just on the edge, just 1 point above the drop.
So, could I just, while Jonathan's here, I saw him on Twitter recently attempt to defend Sunderland's recent poor run of form, I think by citing one 20-minute of period against Liverpool when they weren't completely shocking as evidence. Should you not be more down on them?
1 point from eight.
Yeah, but...
24.
Look
at who those eight games have been against. That block of seven games that began the bad run, they'd beaten Blackpool away, which is the first game after Bent had gone. They then in that run of seven games, they played away at Stoke, away at Everton, which are both tough games for anybody, but Sunderland particularly seem to have problems at those two venues. They then had to play five of the top six in the other five games. It was a really hard run of games. I tweeted on February the 2nd, that if they'd taken 6 points from those seven games, they could be very, very pleased with themselves.
Mm.
They took 1 point, which obviously is not as many as six.
Michael? Yeah.
And then, they were pitiful against City. Against Liverpool, I thought they did pretty well for 20 minutes or so. Then, the controversial penalty decision went against them and their heads dropped and they were absolutely abysmal second half. But, they were good at times against Chelsea when they lost 4-2 at home. I mean, defensively pretty ropey. And that's been the worry, is defensively holes have appeared, dead balls they seem to struggle to defend. But I think that's partly down to the constant injuries they have with the centre-backs. I mean, partly that's self-inflicted by buying John Mensah, who's always injured. But Bramble's had injuries, Michael Turner's just come back. So they've never had a settled pair. You look up until that Blackpool game, they kept 11 clean sheets up till then, which is a Premier League record for Sunderland.
Wow.
So they were defending well early in the season, just things have fallen apart in the last 2 months.
Now, the question is
the downward spiral, is the loss of confidence they've suffered, is that enough to take them down?
Well, they're 6 points clear, I think it should be all right.
Yeah, but Sunderland's capacity to get down themselves and kind of mess things up is... I mean, look at the 15-point season, look at the 19-point season.
Yeah.
They weren't that bad, either of those seasons.
All right, then.
And they were, Saturday's game against West Brom, they were a bit lucky with the two goals. One of them was an own goal, one of them was Phil Barsley hammering it in from 25 yards, which isn't a source of goals you can rely upon.
He's got two this season.
He's got three, I think, actually.
Is it three?
But defensively, they were atrocious. I mean, absolutely abysmal.
A lot of Newcastle fans posting and saying, why do we never talk about Newcastle? There you go. We don't ignore football from your region. More Sunderland chat as soon as possible. Blackpool taking on Wigan, as I mentioned. Tangerines haven't won in five, and everyone's saying, oh yeah, Blackpool are going down. They are still 1 point above the drop, but looking very, very precarious there. They did beat Wigan 4-0 in August, but those were different times. It was a different Blackpool. Everton are up against Blackburn. Look at Everton. They're up there in seventh place, just 4 points behind Liverpool, and Blackburn haven't won in nine matches.
Can I
Please?
Chat?
I was thinking about Blackburn, and I was reading the other day that there was a rumour Steve Keane was going to leave. And I don't think that will happen. I think he'll stay until the end of the season. But of all the men they could get in for six games to keep them up, can you think of anyone better than Sam Allardyce?
Mm. If this was Italy, they would hire him at this point. Because
Zamperini.
Yeah.
I think the chance of Sam Allardyce going back to work for that club are absolutely minimal. I mean, he was absolutely furious.
I don't think his ego would be able to resist to go back and show them what a mistake they made.
I don't know. I think you underestimate how annoyed he was.
Interesting one. West Ham, meantime, are taking on Aston Villa. And the Hammers are in some trouble after looking like they'd turned their season around. They are still only 1 point, though, from safety. Couple of games just to finish with. Arsenal-Liverpool, we'll come on to in a second. West Brom and Chelsea, though, how about this one? Because West Brom are now up in the top half. They're in 10th place. They were beaten 6-0 at Stamford Bridge by Chelsea back on the opening day of the season. That does seem like a long time ago. And Chelsea, how difficult is it going to be for them to pick themselves up after what happened at Old Trafford, their season effectively coming to an end?
Yeah, I think it's a very tricky game for Chelsea. Because I mean, I think having seen West Brom on Saturday, they looked a pretty good side. Yeah. The two goals they conceded, as I said, were both slightly freakish. So they looked tight at the back. They passed the ball around midfield very nicely. They're lively. And Chelsea, I think, have looked increasingly sluggish as the season's gone on. And
West Brom still unbeaten under Roy Hodgson. Do you think that's going to continue in this fixture, Parry?
Yeah, could well do.
Thanks for that. Yeah. Okay. All right. Meantime, then, let's finish off with Arsenal-Liverpool. Michael, first off, a salute to Danny Fisman, who passed away on Wednesday, and the architect of much of Arsenal's recent success. And it has been success, although not in, you know, trophies and silverware, but their position in the world game owes a lot. Is that fair to him?
Yes. Well, I think if you look at off the pitch things, which is what he was responsible for, they've got a new stadium and I think they're profitable, etc. So, yeah.
The Kroenke deal in the meantime seems to have hit all sorts of obstacles.
Yes.
Okay, good. And are Arsenal going to be hitting obstacles this weekend as they host Liverpool, who held them to a 1-1 draw with that comical Pepe Reina own goal right at the death at Anfield back on the opening day of the season?
Yes, should be a really good game. I thought Liverpool were fantastic on Monday against Manchester City. Carroll was the man who scored two goals and got all the headlines, but I thought Suarez was fantastic. Really just buzzing around everywhere, finding space. The kind of player that I imagine might cause Arsenal problems.
I think Carroll will cause some problems as well. I mean, I think that combination's really good. But I mean, Arsenal don't like big, strong centre-forwards.
Actually, he scored the winner, didn't he, early in the season when he was back
in Newcastle. But the goal he scored against City was... the power on that strike was phenomenal. I mean, it wasn't very near the corner, and Hart had absolutely no chance.
Mm. What about the young fellow, John Flanagan, who they brought in at right-back? What did you make of him?
Yeah, I thought he had a decent game. I mean, without having a huge amount to do, I thought he was quietly impressive. I mean, I wouldn't kind of go massively overboard yet, but certainly a lot of reasons to be encouraged. And I think that's one of the very positive things since Dalglish came in, that he's been giving young players the opportunity with Spearing as well.
Right.
Which I think is a positive thing long term, that you know the kids are starting to come through again. Which I know Benitez was pretty miffed at the way the academy was being run, and felt that they brought three people like Owen, Gerrard, and Fowler, and Carragher, and then there'd been nothing after that. Well, possibly this, I don't know if it's too early to say, but possibly we're starting to see the benefit of the changes Benitez made there.
Arsenal currently second place, 7 points behind Man United. However, they do have a game in hand on United, and they have United visiting Emirates on the 1st of May. So, you know, stranger things have happened now that they've started winning again. Liverpool, meantime, if they win this game, will go to within 2 points of fifth place and guaranteed Europa League football, which is pretty exciting.
For
Europe. Right. AT87 says, how is AC Jimbo feeling about his inspired prediction about Man United at the start of the season? Now, pretty silly, AT87. I'm not the only person to be completely flummoxed by their transfer policy and continuing insistence on ageing players, but I have to say that it turns out that Sir Alex Ferguson knows more about selecting a squad of players than I do. How about that? Anyway, that, I think, brings us to the end of this Football Weekly Extra. Many thanks to Jonathan Wilson, okay. Michael Cox and Barry Glendening, producer Ben. I will have a small bijou look at the papers available from Friday morning on the Guardian website. Don't forget those tickets for the Emirates showdown on May the 28th. Lots of fun and games apparently promised there by Uber producer Matt Hall. So get hold of a ticket however you can. And for now, we'll wish you all a happy weekend and see you on Monday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.